Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, May 16th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Masks Start Coming Off. Residents, businesses, officials sound off on CDC's relaxed rules. Now that the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has said people fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can go maskless in most indoor and outdoor spaces, we want to know, has the updated guidance changed minds in the Cedar Valley? It's changed Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart's mind. He issued an emergency proclamation Thursday that ends the city's mask mandate passed in August. It instead encourages people to follow the CDC guidelines and encourages businesses, schools, churches, and other gathering places to develop their own mitigation strategies. The proclamation says people are strongly encouraged to get vaccinated and maintains a state of civil emergency in Waterloo due to the continued presence of COVID-19 in the county. The Blackhawk County Health Department said the area is still at elevated risk for COVID-19 as of Friday. The CDC is also asking people to get vaccinated, and we're hoping that people will follow the rules, Hart said. In Cedar Falls, Mayor Rob Green is leaving the decision to City Council, which will vote on the matter Monday. He favors ending the city's mask mandate, as the requirement will have accomplished its purpose. Though previously necessary, I don't see the data justifies a citywide government mask requirement at this point, Green said. Cedar Falls Councilman Dave Sires, who has voted to end the city mask mandate in place since last fall, expressed optimism his side would have the votes to overturn it Monday, given the new guidance. I think that we shouldn't have had masks for a long time, Sires said. People need to choose their own health perspectives. But a possible swing vote in Councilman Simon Harding isn't a sure bet. I've been doing lots of research and have been leaning towards not voting for it again for a variety of reasons, Harding said. But he cautioned that he would keep his mind open until we've had a discussion. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican, who represents Northeast Iowa's 1st Congressional District, said she cheered when the CDC guidance came down Thursday. It's great news for us, she said during the weekly call with reporters Friday, noting that it was the work of scientists and healthcare workers that made COVID-19 vaccines available and plentiful. I think it sends a great message that people can get back to their freedom, and that's what we want right now. Some businesses agreed the CDC guidance would prompt them to drop mask requirements. Basil Pizza on East 4th Street in Waterloo said it will, following the latest recommendations, phasing out a mask requirement in place since last year. We will be relaxing our staff mask policy, said owner Tony Eschild, adding that all those who work there are vaccinated. Owner Greg Brown of Epic Finds next door said that he followed the city's guidance on masks, but relaxed his rules after the CDC guidance came out. I'm glad that the mask requirement is easing, he said. I think it will encourage other folks to come out to businesses and shop like they used to. Others are more cautious. Tyson Foods said Friday that it is not making any immediate change to its mask mandate for employees. According to company spokesperson Liz Croston, she said that the company is reviewing the new CDC guidance and figuring out how it aligns with other federal and state workplace guidance to protect workers. And at least three other downtown businesses asked about their mask requirements, including the Soul Book Nook, Ivy Trellis, and Pretty Good Co., all said that they would be keeping their requirement in place for now. For right now, we will probably still wear them here, just for safety reasons, said Mary Heller, owner of Ivy Trellis. She said she's open to revisiting that after a period of time to see how it's going and if the amount of cases go up or even further down. Local residents are mixed on whether the CDC guidance will influence them. At least some Cedar Valley residents noted that they would abide only wearing masks where mandated to do so. I have been doing it out of respect for businesses' requests, but it's time to move on, said Hudson resident Peter Schneider, who noted that he was fully vaccinated, but he won't be throwing his masks out. I may consider starting again in the fall to prevent influenza movement. Robert Coyle of Cedar Falls said he's already been indoors without masks with other vaccinated people, but wears a mask in public, partly through caution, as well as courtesy slash solidarity with those who are not yet vaccinated. Coyle said the new guidance means he'll only wear a mask in public spaces that require it. I will wear a mask if businesses require me to, said Karen Schatz of Waterloo. Otherwise, I will no longer wear one. Others weren't quite comfortable with ditching their masks. I'll probably still be a little cautious about inside gatherings for a while, said Paulette Seal of Waterloo. I probably will go back and forth, said Kelly Hangerman of Waterloo. If stores stop requiring, I will probably stop wearing it, if I'm pretty sure that some level of distance. Betty Galloway Derrick had a stricter metric. I will continue to wear my mask in public until there is no hospitalizations and deaths for 2 weeks, she said. Now, let's move on to the article, Cedar Valley Businesses Struggle to Find Workers. With warmer temperatures and vaccines readily available, many residents feel more comfortable dining inside or out at their favorite restaurant. It's what restaurant owners and managers have been waiting for since the pandemic decimated businesses last year. After multiple rounds of stimulus checks and supplemental unemployment funds, Iowa Business Council Executive Director Joe Murphy said people are spending more money. Consumer spending is through the roof. People have a need and desire to get out, he said. But it's not all businesses are able to keep up with the demand. Some area restaurants are being forced to reduce the days and hours they are open. It's not because of a lack of customers, it's a widespread shortage in workers. I directly attribute this to a lack of available help, said Gary Shoemaker, owner of Lincoln Park Perk in downtown Waterloo. Shoemaker and his wife, Christy, have owned and operated the coffee shop and daytime restaurant at 218 East 4th Street since 2018. After restaurants were allowed to reopen last year, none of their employees returned, so the two have been covering all positions, serving coffee drinks, making food, and running the cash register. They've also had to reduce days of operation from 6 days a week to four. As soon as we can find the help, we'll begin reopening more hours, Shoemaker said. The owners at the Brass Tap, James and Walter Burtis at 421 Main Street in downtown Cedar Falls, also are feeling the heat. Both brothers have had to take on at least one shift per day that used to be covered by an employee. I prefer to be able to walk around and take care of customers and fill in when needed, James said Thursday as he was bartending. It's unfortunate. Until we get the staff back up, it's just not the perfect customer service situation. They've also had to cut 2 days out of their normal operating business hours and close earlier than normal on a daily basis. It's not because we're not busy, we have the customers, he said. I just can't, in good conscience, make them work that long. We're trying to make the employees last as long as they can without burning them out. Before the pandemic, Lincoln Perk had 4 employees. Each cited a different reason for not being able to return. 2 of them were directly related to COVID-19. One employee is homeschooling and taking care of her grandchildren to allow the parents to work. Another employee said that it was too risky to work with the ongoing pandemic. The other two changed careers. It's been very difficult, Shoemaker said. There's a few applicants, but very few. Brass Tap launched on Main Street in Cedar Falls in 2017, specializing in craft beer, upscale pub food, and live entertainment. When the pandemic began in last March of last year, Brass Tap employees were temporarily laid off until James and Walter acquired more safety materials like masks and sanitizing stations. Although there was not nearly enough business to justify returning all 27 employees, James and Walter felt that they had a responsibility to keep them employed, so they found odd jobs like cleaning and painting to add to their timesheets. Good employees are hard to find. If you have good employees, you need to make sure that you take care of them. Otherwise, you'll lose them quick, James said. But nearly half of the employees didn't return. James said about 5 were University of Northern Iowa students who moved back to their hometowns when the college shut down campus last March, and 3 others moved out of town. Spring is the other time of the year the owners typically hire more employees to ensure they're covered, But for the busy summer season, for the busy summer season, this year they are struggling to find dedicated applicants. It's the first time we've gone this long without being able to hire, James said. They've received about 80 applicants this year, but only about half of them have returned phone calls after submitting the application. Only about 10 applicants arrived for their interview, James said, noting he hired nearly all of them, but only a handful of them showed up for their first day of work, even after filling out paperwork to start the job. With the 5 recent hires, the Brass Tap now has 21 employees. We've never experienced this. We've been down a couple of bodies, but we've never been able to get interviews. We've never not been able to get interviews or applicants in, especially after they've been hired, he said. The problem is widespread across other industries in Iowa as well, Murphy said. The Iowa Business Council represents 22 of Iowa's largest employers. We're seeing it in every single one of our members' industries, and also among our partners and stakeholders, Murphy said. In some ways, it's a really unique and almost fortunate problem to have. Iowa's unemployment rate is among the lowest in the country, Murphy said. Coupled with the state's high labor participation, Iowa faces a persistent shortage of available workers. On Tuesday, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Iowa will no longer participate in federal unemployment benefit programs, citing a strong labor market and recovering economy. Effective June 12th, the state will not disburse the extra $300 per week for unemployment benefits through the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program. Iowa will no longer provide benefits to the self-employed, underemployed, independent contractors, and individuals who have been unable to work due to health or COVID-19-related reasons through the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. The overwhelming message we receive from employers these days is the lack of workforce that is adversely affecting their ability to recover from the pandemic, said Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend. A record 44% of small business owners reported job openings that could not be filled over the past 3 months, though the National Federation of Independent Business in Iowa. But statistics show that there are other reasons employees aren't able to return to work. A report released by the National Low Income Housing Coalition shows Iowans earning minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, cannot afford rent for a one-bedroom home anywhere in the state unless they work at least 67 hours a week. A two-bedroom unit would require Iowans earning minimum wage to work 85 hours a week to afford rent. The report found Iowans need to earn $15.46 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment renting for $804 a month, the amount identified by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development as fair market rent in the state. Bertis declined to comment on the reduction of benefits, saying he hasn't seen enough information to form an opinion. Shoemaker said he thinks it was the right move. We were told that a person drawing unemployment plus the $300 makes more money than if he'd come to work for us, he said. What kind of attitude are they going to have coming to work 20 to 30 hours a week versus sitting at home? Now let's move on to the article, Waterloo Shooting Kills Man, 2 Injured. 2 women transported to Waterloo Hospital with gunshot wounds. One person is dead and 2 others injured following an early morning shooting in Waterloo. The identities of the victims weren't immediately available, but police said that one man died and 2 women were taken to a local hospital with gunshot wounds. The women's injuries don't appear to be life-threatening, according to the police. The shooting erupted around 3:30 a.m. Saturday in the 1400 block of Grant Avenue. When officers arrived, they found the man collapsed in a gravel alley next to 1408 Grant. He was pronounced dead at the scene, according to officers. One woman was sent to the hospital by ambulance, and another arrived by a private vehicle, police said. Neighbors reported hearing what sounded like 8 to 10 gunshots, followed by yelling. A soda bottle and other items marked in the area where the deceased was found, a pair of pink fuzzy slippers were in the roadway, and police found shell casings where the alley continued across the street. Authorities found a trail that stretched down nearby Linwood Avenue toward Wilston Avenue, and a large section of the block was sectioned off with crime scene tape. Earlier, around 1:20 a.m., officers responded to a report of gunfire in the area of Randolph and Wellington streets about two blocks away. No injuries were reported, and it wasn't clear if the incidents were connected. Now for the article, Schools Fear Dropout Surge. Districts across the U.S. scramble to track down students and get them to graduate. U.S. educators are doing everything they can to track down high school students who stopped showing up to classes and to help them get the credits needed to graduate, amid an anticipated surge of the country's dropout rate during the coronavirus. There isn't data available yet on how the pandemic has affected the nation's overall dropout rate. 2019 is the last year for which it is available, and many school officials say it's too early to know how many students who stopped logging on for distance learning don't plan to return. But soaring numbers of students who are failing classes are chronically absent, have experts fearing the worst, and schools have been busy tracking down wayward seniors through social media, knocking on their doors, and assigning staff to help them make up for lost time, and in some cases even relaxing graduation requirements. When students drop out, they typically look for an out, an opportunity to leave, and this has provided that. Unfortunately, Sandy Addis, chairman of the National Dropout Prevention Center, said recently, referring to the pandemic, his group believes that the dropout rate has spiked this year and will remain high for years. At one high school in Kansas City, Kansas, staff members have made thousands of calls to the families of at-risk students, said Troy Pitch, who supervises high school principals in the city. If we lose a student, it is going to be after kicking and screaming and fighting tooth and nail for them, Pitch said. Many districts were forgiving last spring when schools shut down abruptly, freezing grades unless students wanted to improve them. That made this year the first for which schools would feel the effect of the pandemic on student performance and engagement. The early signs aren't encouraging. The United States Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization warned that the pandemic had put 24 million children worldwide at risk of dropping out of school, and the pandemic's effect could erase gains the U.S. made in reducing its dropout rate, which fell from 9.3% in 2007 to 5.1% in 2019, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Not finishing high school significantly hurts a person's earnings potential, with dropouts bringing home an average of $150 less per week than graduates, according to U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data. To keep students on track, some local governments and school systems have waived certain testing requirements for graduation or changed grading policies so that missed assignments aren't as damaging. But such leniency carries the risk of watering down academic standards, said Russell Rumberger, a professor emeritus of education at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who has written about dropouts. If they let you pass with a D and you don't have to do very much to do it, maybe technically you are getting a diploma, but you aren't getting the same type of diploma, and you may have gotten prior to the pandemic, when the standards were higher, he said. A National Dropout Prevention Center report predicted a doubling or tripling of the number of students who were at risk for failing behind academically and not graduating. Among them, for much of this school year, was Jose Solano Hernandez, a 17-year-old senior at Wyandotte High School in Kansas City, Kansas. In January, when he was at his lowest point following the deaths of one grandparent from COVID-19 and another from cancer in the same week, he estimated that he had missed 8 assignments in each of his classes. "I wouldn't make my parents proud," he recalled thinking as he struggled to learn virtually at night while working by day at a mechanic's shop. Solano Hernandez has been slowly chipping away at his backlog of work since his school brought him back and other struggling seniors for extra in-person help more than a month before the rest of the student body returned. At the end of March, he said that the change brought relief and that he is now hopeful he'll graduate. Mary Stewart, the school's principal, said that there was radio silence from hundreds of students in the fall, but the number who weren't accounted for shrank to about 40 by the spring after staff hunted down siblings and scrolled through Facebook searching for clues to their whereabouts. Now let's go to the article, Network Cashes In on Vaccine Disinformation. The couple in the website videos could be hawking any number of products. You're going to love owning the Platinum Package, Charlene Bollinger says, as the picture of a DVD set and other products flash on screen. Her husband, Ty, promises a director's cut edition. Click the orange button, his wife says, to join in the fight for health freedom. Or more specifically, to pay $199 to $499 for the Bollinger's video series, The Truth About Vaccines 2020. The Bollingers are part of an ecosystem of for-profit companies, non-profit groups, and social media accounts that stoke fear and distrust of COVID-19 vaccines, using what medical experts say is often misleading and false information. An investigation by the Associated Press has found that the couple works closely with other prominent in the anti-vaccine movement, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his Children's Health Defense, to drive sales through affiliate marketing relationships. According to the Bollingers, there's big money involved. They have said that they have sold tens of millions of dollars in products and paid out $12 million to affiliates. This is a disinformation industry, said Dorit Rice, a professor of the University of California Hastings College of the Law, who specializes in vaccine policy. The Bollingers were already in the business of selling vaccine disinformation before COVID-19 hit, but the pandemic presented them and others huge opportunity to expand. The Bollingers aligned themselves with right-wing supporters of former President Donald Trump, establishing a super PAC to push what they call medical freedom, participating in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, and prompting lies like the assertion that the election was stolen from Trump. On the afternoon of January 6th, as supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol, the Bollingers held a rally just blocks away. As emergency vehicles screamed past, Charlene Bollinger celebrated from the stage, calling it an amazing day. Meanwhile, Ty Bollinger stood at the doors of the Capitol though he says that he did not enter. The Tennessee couple's social media accounts have been identified as among the top vaccine misinformation super spreaders by organizations such as NewsGuard and the Center for Countering Digital Hate. They have more than 1 million followers on Facebook, and Charlene Bollinger has said that their email list has a couple million people on it. Public health experts, including U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, said such disinformation undermines the effort to immunize enough people to stop the pandemic. The Bollinger declined to interview requests and didn't respond to the AP's emailed questions. Ty Bollinger began their business several years ago with books and DVDs such as The Truth About Cancer, which medical experts say included unproven information about alternatives to chemotherapy. He describes himself as a medical researcher, but the AP could find no indication he has any scientific training. In 2017, the business expanded into vaccines. When the coronavirus hit, it pivoted again, selling false or baseless information about COVID-19. Their false and unsubstantiated claims include linking 5G wireless signals to the virus and that adverse vaccine reactions are underreported. One recent post falsely claimed that vaccines are more likely to kill you than the virus. Some commenters were swayed. Thank you so much for all the information you provide us. I will not get the vaccine, one wrote. Now let's read the quick article, Salvation Army Resumes Dine-In Lunch. The Salvation Army of Waterloo Cedar Falls is moving the hot lunch meal program back inside the Corp Community Center. Starting Monday, lunch will be dine-in from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Those who drive should park in the front parking lot off Franklin Street. The Salvation Army has provided 20,373 meals to individuals and distributed 237,473 pounds of perishable food since October in response to COVID-19. At the community center lobby, all individuals will have their temperature taken and hand sanitizer will be provided before entering the dining area. Tables will be spaced out with only 4 chairs at each table. Chairs and tables will be sanitized after each use. The staff, volunteers, and diners are required to wear a face cloth/mask, except while eating. The perishable food pantry will remain open from noon to 1 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays. If driving, patrons should enter the rear parking lot of the Salvation Army off Logan Avenue. Distribution will be drive-through. The walk-in emergency service program will also resume. Walk-in services will be offered from 9 a.m. to noon, Mondays and Wednesdays. Walk-in services do not include rent or utilities. These requests must still be made online. The all-purpose assistance form and rent utility assistance form can be accessed at www.sawaterloo.org and www.facebook.com/sawaterloocf. The youth center after-school hours are from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. Summer hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and began at the conclusion of the school year. Volunteers are needed to help with the lunch meals or perishable food pantry on the days listed above. Please call 319-235-9358 to volunteer and obtain additional information. Now, let's move on to the article, 5 Sullivan Brothers Center Could Get a New Name Monday. The 5 Sullivan Brothers Convention Center could get a new name by Monday if approved by the Waterloo City Council. The long-standing downtown fixture could soon be rechristened to the Waterloo Convention Center, according to a proposed resolution. Management company Spectra made this suggestion for easier recognition of location, according to city documents. Mayor Quinton Hart talked with the Sullivan family about the change. City documents say, a new outdoor plaza space at the convention center will be named in honor of the Sullivan family, according to city documents. Spectra recommended the name Sullivan Brothers Plaza and would plan to use the full name of Waterloo Convention Center at the Sullivan Brothers Plaza on marketing materials. City documents show, that would include logos, social media sites, and more. The City Council could also give naming rights to Spectra at Monday's meeting, which would allow the company to forego City Council approval and get go-ahead orders from the mayor. The Sullivan brothers, George, Francis, Joseph, Madison, and Albert, died in November 1942 when the ship USS Juneau sunk off Guadalcanal during World War II. The tragedy marked the greatest combat-related loss by life of a single family at once in American military history. A second-floor renovation at the convention center also needs approval Monday by council members. The city got 2 bids, the lowest base bid at nearly $1.6 million from the Cardinal Construction of Waterloo, and another of nearly $1.7 million from Don Gardner Construction of Waterloo. Another resolution up for approval Monday is an up to $7,500 agreement with Spectra for possible support services to city staff. This would include raising funds for convention center renovations, like the outdoor plaza space, according to city documents. More than 97,000 in change orders for convention center projects are up for consideration Monday. These are items not included in original projections for construction projects. About $1,600 of funds are for drywall patching, and the rest is for leak fixes and the skywalk above the commercial street. People who want to attend or speak at Monday's Waterloo's City Council meeting can attend in person at City Hall, or they can register online to participate via video platform Zoom. Let's just read a few Metro briefs real quick. Teen vaccines now available. CVS Health is taking COVID-19 vaccine appointments for adolescents aged 12 to 15 now across Iowa. The Pfizer-BioNTech will be the vaccine used, and a parent or guardian must accompany the child. Contact your local CVS for more information. Vaccines available for persons 12 to 15, Hy-Vee and Unity Point are now administering the COVID-19 vaccines for individuals 12 to 15. Pfizer BioNTech has been approved for this age group. Parents or guardians must accompany the minor, and you can walk in or schedule an appointment. Contact your local Hy-Vee pharmacy or call Unity Point at 319-226-2600 with any questions. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, May 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. David Lee Greer, Sr. David Lee Greer, Sr., 74, of Waterloo, died Saturday, May 8th at home. He was born March 22nd, 1947, in Salis, Mississippi, son of George and Annie Glee Bentley Greer. He married Linda Levy on August 4th, 1968, in Waterloo. They later divorced. He married Catherine Landfair on August 27th, 2013, in Waterloo. David Lee owned and operated Old Greer's Works and Greer's Funeral Home in Waterloo for many years. Survivors include his wife, three sons, David L. Greer, Jr. of Clarksville, Tennessee, and Darren Greer, Sr. and Daniel L. Greer, Sr., both of Waterloo, two stepsons, Declaris Corone Landfair and Ricky Martrice Perkins, Jr., both of Waterloo, and five grandchildren and one great-grandson, a brother, Percy Lee Greer of Waterloo, four sisters, Minnie Harmon Catherine Lou Weatherby, and Betty Jo Weatherby, all of Salis, Mississippi, and Mary Lee Nash of Waterloo, a sister-in-law, Sarah Greer of Waterloo, and an aunt, Alice Denton of Waterloo. He is preceded in death by two grandsons, three brothers, George Greer, Jr., Dave E. Greer, and Mose Greer, a sister, Annie Viola Greer, three brothers-in-law, John Weatherby, Lee Harvey Harmon, and Jesse Lee Nash, and two sisters-in-law, May Ella Greer and Catherine Greer. A graveside service was Saturday, May 15th at Bethlehem Cemetery, Salis, Mississippi. There will be no visitation. Greer's Funeral Home, 232-8683. It is in charge of local arrangements. Condolences may be left with www.winterfuneralhome.com. Lillian Marie Meinhardt. Lillian Marie Meinhardt was born on August 31st, 1923, east of Chelsea in Tama County, the first child born to James and Christine Prusha of Tama. She received her education in country schools and graduated from Tama High School in 1941. Following high school, she clerked at the Ben Franklin store in Tama and did housework for area families. She met Wilbert Meinhardt at the ZBCJ Hall in Cultier, and they were married on June 4th, 1946, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Tama. She helped her husband with farm work and on the home place of her parents, south of Hudson. Lillian was proud of her flowers and vegetable garden, tended laying hens, and prepared many hearty meals for the Meinhardt hog sales. In 1983, they retired to Hudson for 24 years before moving to Traer. She and Wilbert were married for 61 years before he died on October 23, 2007. She enjoyed fishing, traveling, playing cards, hunting mushrooms, and polka music. She made quilts for each of her children and grandchildren. Her family's fondest memories of her and her cooking and baking, especially cloches, pecan pies, noodles, and rosettes. She was a terrific cook, and everyone knew it. Her children will never forget the joy of hunting mushrooms and learning to fish. Her greatest joy was spending time with her family, especially her grandchildren and many great-grandchildren. At 97, she still knew each grandchild and great-grandchild's birthday. She was a member of Blessings Parish for many years and currently St. Paul's Parish in Traer. Lillian passed away peacefully at the age of 97 on Saturday, May 1st, 2021, at Sunrise Hills Care Center in Traer. She is survived by a daughter, Kathy Weber of Dysart, a son, Myron Meinhardt of Hudson, 8 grandchildren, Brian Weber, Buckingham, Jennifer Dryling of Lenexa, Kansas, Christina Weber Lau of Oakland, California, Brad Weber of Manco, Minnesota, Jeremy Ludwig Eugene of Oregon, Melissa Culver of Port Orchard, Washington, Jason Ludwig of Gig Harbor, Washington, and Mitch Meinhardt of Hudson. 18 great-grandchildren, Bella and Alexa Weber, Brooklyn, Aiden, and Jacob Dryling, Ethan, Luke, and Garrett Weber, Oscar and Cora Ludwig, Jersey Chamberlain, Brady Morgan Culliver, Isabella, Vincent Roman, and Sophia Ludwig, and Denna Meinhardt, a brother, Paul Prussia of Amana, a sister-in-law, Mary Lou Prussia, and nieces and nephews. Lillian was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Wilbert, a brother, Floyd Prussia, a sister, Maxine Kopfera, brothers-in-law, Alfred Kopfera and Marvin Meinhardt, sisters-in-law, Therese Prussia and Sylvia Meinhardt, and two nephews, Dan and Kevin Prussia. Mass and Christian burial will be on Friday, May 7th, 2021, at St. Paul's Catholic Church at 10:30 a.m., with burial to follow at the Blessing Cemetery south of Hudson. The visitation will be Thursday, May 6th, at 2021, at St. Paul's Catholic Church from 4 to 7 p.m. Please direct memorials to St. Paul's Catholic Church, Return the Favor Quilt, or Iowa Public Television. Henry Ricus Hank Memon. Henry Ricus Hank Memon, age 93, of Shell Rock, Iowa, died Thursday, May 13th, 2021, at his home. Hank was born on December 10th, 1927, in Clarksville, Iowa, the son of Claus and Grace Memon. He was baptized on October 7th, 1928, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Clarksville, and attended country school north of Shell Rock. On February 26, 1947, Hank was united in marriage to Velda Franken at St. John's Lutheran Church Parsonage in Clarksville. After their wedding, the couple moved to the farm on Union Avenue of Shell Rock, where they farmed together their entire lives. Hank was a member of Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock. His greatest enjoyment in life was spending time and making memories with his family and friends. Hank's memory is honored by wife Velda Memon of Shell Rock, daughter Janelle Grover of Rogers, Arkansas, two sons, Bob Memon of Shell Rock and Dennis Memon of Omaha, Nebraska, 6 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren, and a brother, Jake Memon of Green, Iowa. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister Carrie Gambini, and 3 brothers, Ralph Memon, Raymond Memon, and Coert Miller. Visitation will be held on Sunday, May 16th, at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Shell Rock, where the family will greet friends from 1 to 4 p.m. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, May 17th, at Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock, with Pastor Kim Smith officiating. Burial will follow in Butler Center Cemetery, rural Allison, Iowa. Memorials may be made directly to Hank's family, and online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorson.com, 319-885-4321. Now, let's move on to some sports articles, starting with Ron Bauer pulls Preakness upset, Baffert's Medina Spirit third. Ron Bauer left Medina Spirit behind and put horse racing's latest controversy on the back burner. Little known, Ron Bauer sprung an 11-1 upset to win the Preakness on Saturday, passing Bob Baffert's Kentucky Derby winner to end a potential Triple Crown bid that would have carried a giant asterisk. Medina Spirit finished third and will not go on to the Belmont with a Triple Crown on the line and a potential Derby disqualification hanging over the sport. "A little disappointed, but we'll go on from here," said assistant trainer Jimmy Barnes, who saddled the horses in Baffert's absence. Baffert was not present at the Pimlico racecourse, opting to stay away because of the controversy surrounding Midna Spirit, who tested positive for the steroid Bethamazone, a poster in poster retesting. He said in a spotlight-stealing statement hours before the race, "Today is not about Bob Baffert. Instead, it is about Medina Spirit and all the other equine athletes in our tremendous sport." All the focus, nonetheless, was on 2-1 favorite Medina Spirit, Baffert, and his other Preakness runner, Concert Tour, who went off at 4-1. Medina Spirit was passed for the first time in his career by Rombauer, who won by 3.5 lengths over the second place Midnight Bourbon. "I had to come out running to get my position," said Medina Spirit jockey John Valquez, who fell to 0-4-11 in the Preakness. "I knew that he was going to be pressed today. I was hoping that he wouldn't overdo it, and we did." Concert Tour was a disappointing ninth in a 10-horse field. "I'm at a loss for words," said Concert Tour jockey Mike Smith, who left Midnight Bourbon after the Derby to ride Baffert's other Preakness horse. He just wasn't going anywhere. Maryland racing officials required Concert Tour and Medina Spirit to undergo additional testing and monitoring as conditions to run in the Preakness. Those three rounds of tests came back Friday, clearing them to race. None of the other horses were subject to that level of scrutiny, which came out of the situation at Churchill Downs in Baffert's four other medication violations over the past 13 months with other horses. That was set aside for at least the 1:34.78 it took for Rombauer to complete the 1 3/16 mile race, paying $26.50 to win, $10 to place, and $5.20 to show. "He broke as expected, and I thought he put enough pressure on Medina Spirit to make it a horse race, and then he ended up second," Midnight Bourbon trainer Steve Asuman said. "He showed up, he's improving, and he's not there yet, all that the same time." Midnight Bourbon was the sixth in the Kentucky Derby behind Medina Spirit, whose victory still hangs in the balance with a second test yet to be analyzed. It's unclear how long that will take. Trainer Michael McCarthy won a Triple Crown race for the first time and captured the Preakness before the Hall of Famer Todd Pletcher, for whom he worked as an assistant before opening his own barn. Pletcher gave McCarthy a bear hug after the race. Rombauer is owned by John and Diane Fradkin, a far cry from Medina Spirit's Zayden Racing Stables and other horse racing conglomerates. He won for the third time in 7 starts. McCarthy choked back tears while talking about everyone involved with Rombauer. "Means a lot to be here. Participate on a day like this," he said. "Happy for the Fradkins. Just goes to show you that small players in the game can be successful as well." Rombauer busted the bias of horses hugging the rail on the dirt at Pimlico Racecourse all day, going past Midnight Bourbon and Medina Spirit down the stretch and winning by 3.5 lengths. Jockey Flavian Pratt won the Preakness 2 years after being elevated to the Derby winner aboard Country Horse when Maximum Security was disqualified. "Of course, it's a lot different when you cross the wire first. You get that feeling," Pratt said. "It's a lot of joy." With the usual joy replaced by chatter about Baffert and medication violations, the Preakness was run in front of a limited capacity of 10,000 fans, a fraction of the crowd of 100,000 plus that typically packs Pimlico on the third Saturday in May. Masks were still required because of the city and track protocols. This was a short turnaround for the 2020 Preakness, which was run last fall as the third leg of the Triple Crown with no fans allowed. Now let's move on to the article, "Iowa's Tyler Goodson Aiming High in 2021. Tyler Goodson has his eye on the prize. As the University of Iowa running back prepares for his junior season, the returning first-team All-Big Ten selection, who has led the Hawkeyes in rushing the past two seasons, has set a lofty goal for himself. "Let's just say that I want to be the Doak Walker Award winner," Goodson said, after Iowa wrapped up its final spring practice earlier this month. "That's what I want, and I feel like the offensive line in front of me will help me get there." Goodson sees winning the award presented to the nation's top college running back as the natural's next step in a productive career which started with the 5'10", 200-pound Suwannee, Georgia native becoming the first true freshman to lead Iowa in rushing. After gaining 638 yards on 134 carries in 2019, Goodson ran for a team-leading 762 yards on 143 carries during the Hawkeyes' shortened 6-2 season last fall. He also caught 15 passes for 52 yards, an area of his game that he continued to concentrate on as Iowa worked its way through its 15 spring practices. "I'm always working on catching the ball. That's totally part of the game for running backs now, and running good routes and catching the ball and picking up yards after the catch is something that I expect to be able to do," Goodson said. Iowa coach Kirk Fertinez has watched Goodson work to improve his game. He said that it's not just lip service, there's plenty of sweat behind Goodson's words. "He's practiced every day with great attitude," Fertinez said. "He works hard." Goodson is gaining feedback from a new position coach as well. Former Hawkeye Ladell Betts became Iowa's running back assistant in March when Derek Foster left to coach the same position in the NFL with the Los Angeles Chargers. A 9-year NFL veteran following his career with the Hawkeyes, Betts resumes and coaching style has the attention of Goodson. "He knows the game and understands what running backs go through," Goodson said. "He's doing a good job of instilling us in his knowledge and what we need to do." Betts, the only running back in Iowa history to lead the program in rushing four straight seasons, continues to rank second on the Hawkeyes' career rushing list and is fourth in all-purpose yards. "He sees the ability of Goodson to extend his game beyond carrying the football, something he wants all of the running backs he now works with to embrace. I think one of the misconceptions about running backs is a lot of people think we just run the ball, but there are a lot of nuances to the position. Being in the NFL, you learn those nuances. Whether it'll be how to run routes, how to catch the ball, how to block, all those things separate you from your average tailback and they take their game to the next level," Betts said. "There are running backs all over the country who know how to run, but can you do the other things?" That is where things begin for Goodson as a junior, holding on to hopes of joining Sean Green as the only Hawkeye to ever win the Doak Walker Award. Green accomplished that in 2008, rushing for 1,850 yards and 20 touchdowns. Like Green, Goodson wants to be a workhorse in the Hawkeye backfield, but he expects himself more of himself. Goodson became the 50th Iowa player to rush for 1,000 yards in the last season, and currently sits at 29th on that all-time list with 1,400 yards. He enters the upcoming season after ranking second in the Big Ten with 762 rushing yards and third with 7 rushing touchdowns last season. His off-season preparation has included working on his receiving abilities and concentrating on improving his blocking skills and pass protection situations. He has watched more film than ever, becoming a true student of the game as he works to improve. "I just want to do everything I can to help the team win," Goodson said. "If that's getting a lot of carries or not getting a lot of carries, I'm good with that, whatever it takes." Now let's go on to the article, Northern Iowa Falls, an MVC Softball Championship Game. Sarah Harness fired a two-hitter and was backed by a pair of solo home runs as Southern Illinois beat Northern Iowa 2-0 Saturday in the Missouri Valley Conference Softball Tournament Championship Game. Harness allowed just 4 base runners as the Salukis improved to 37-14. "I felt Sarah Harness was a humongous factor in today's game," UNI head coach Ryan Jacobs said. "We saw her recently and had success against her. We were a step behind her today. They did a good job of calling pitches and she did a fantastic job of executing those pitches." It was a great game by KP, Caitlin Packard, as well. They got two good swings, and that's all it took. It was a great game. The victory averaged a three-game sweep. SIU suffered to UNI 31-18 in Cedar Falls last weekend, a series that the Panthers beat Harness twice. Elizabeth Huckleberry homered in the fifth to give SIU a 1-0 lead, and Jenny Jansen hit her third home run of the tournament in the top of the sixth. The Panthers left runners in scoring positions in both the sixth and the seventh inning, with those being UNI's best scoring chances. Harness no-hit the Panthers through five innings before Adria Opiola singled with one out in the sixth. Cameron Schaffer singled in the seventh for UNI's other hit. Panthers starting pitcher Kaylin Packard worked all seven innings, allowing just six hits. She struck out five. Packard, Opiola, and Hannah Kelly were all named to be the all-tournament team. Freshman second baseman Taylor Hogan was named the Elite 17 Award winner. The award is given to the student athlete with the highest GPA playing in the championship game. Hogan has a 3.98 GPA in communication disorders. UNI will now play a waiting on whether the Panthers will receive an at-large bid into the NCAA tournament. UNI was ranked in the top 50 with the latest RPI rankings. With the way we played the last 3 weeks of the season, we are directly in the middle of the bubble. It could go either way, Jacobs said. It depended on whether or not the league gets credit for being in a tough league this year. I feel like this is the closest we have ever been, and more in conversation of on who is going to get in the league than we have been. The selection show will begin at 8 p.m. tonight, Sunday, on ESPN2. Now let's read the article, Gable Museum now taking registrations for 22nd golf outing. The National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum is now taking registrations for its second 22nd annual golf tournament at Prairie Links in Waverly. The tournament will be held on June 25th as part of the two-day 2021 Glenn Brand Wrestling Hall of Fame Iowa introduction ceremonies. Headlining the event this year is 13-time world medalist and 2-time Olympic gold medalist Bruce Baumgartner. The two-day event will begin on Thursday, June 24th, where Baumgartner will sign his display at the Waterloo-located museum on 303 Jefferson Street. Baumgartner will be available for autographs from 4 to 5 p.m. prior to a Hall of Fame social at Prairie Links Golf and Event Center. Bruce Baumgartner is the most highly decorated wrestler in United States history. Gable Museum Executive Director Jim Miller said, "We are excited to have him here for our biggest event." This year, Glenn Brand's Hall of Fame honors are Megan Black, Mike Diana, Dwight Hinson, David Kjeldgaard, Gary Steffensmeyer, and the 1991 and 1992 National Champion Iowa Wrestling teams. The Happel family will receive the Bowlesby Family Legacy Award. Retired Don Bosco of Gilbertville head coach Tom Hogan will receive the Bob Siddons Iowa High School Coaching Excellence Award. Bill Tate Sr. is this year's honoree of the Russ Smith Community Impact Award. Drake Alana will be awarded the Bob Steelage Iowa High School Wrestler of the Year Award, and Millie Peach is the Iowa High School Female Wrestler of the Year winner. Golfers who wish to participate in the event and attend the Hall of Fame ceremonies following the competition can register by calling the museum at 319-233-0745 or emailing dgmstaff@nwhof.org. Cost of the golf is $150 for an individual and $600 for a four-person team. The museum is also accepting sponsors for the event. All proceeds will benefit Dan Gable Museum and help bring it closer to its mission to preserve history, recognize excellence, and inspire future generations. This is an important event for us and our future, especially coming off a year with a pandemic, Miller said. It's going to be a great weekend and a lot of fun. Miller added every member of the 1991 and 1992 Iowa teams have been indicated that they will attend the event. Let's finish up today with the article, Wartburg Men First, Women Second at ARC Outdoor Track and Field Championships. The Wartburg College men claimed an American River Conference outdoor track and field title Saturday with a 247 points. The Knights got event victories from Riley Barrett in the decathlon, Joe Freiberger in the 10,000s, Matt Heinzman in the 1500, Dallas Wright in the 110 hurdles and 400 hurdles, and Derek Smith in the 100 and 200. Wright's times in the 110 and 400 hurdles were both ARC championship marks, and his time in the 110 hurdles was the all-time best mark in conference history. Wartburg also won the 4x100 in a championship record time of 41.13. Wright, Riley Nolan, Randy Williams, and Smith made up that team. The 4x400 team of Zach Abbey, Dayton Love, Wyatt Schmidt, and Dalton Martin won in 3 minutes 18.03 seconds. In the women's competition, Wartburg finished second with 184 points. Brayna Christopher won the high jump, and R.B. Fisher took the 3,000 steeplechase, 1,500 and 5,000, and Bella Alpers the pole vault. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, May 16th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.